Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to wellness experts ready to inform and inspire. This week's topic is finding joy and fluidity in stuckness. My guest is Dr. Julia Cuccard, leadership coach, existential psychotherapist, and personal and professional expert on stuckness, based in Cape Town. Welcome, Julia.
Oh, thank you, Mariëtte. I'm really happy to be here talking to you today. Thank you.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us. After our conversation, Julia will give us three tips around stuckness and fluidity, and then it will be fun question time. You know, Julia, before I met you, I never gave the least thought to a concept which turns out to be crucial to our lives and growth, and that is stuckness.
It's very important. It's a critical part of being a human. It's how we learn and grow.
You've just published a book called The Art and Joy of Stuckness for Coaches and Their Clients, based on your doctoral research. And we'll talk about that as we go along. But I'd like you first to tell us about the work you do.
Okay, so for the last 30 years, I've been working in learning and development, also working as a coach, and more recently as an existential psychotherapist. I largely deal with leaders, but I also have a small private practice that actually looks a lot more at stuckness. So that's broadly what I do at the moment. And I write, and I'm writing more and more. So yes, that's what I do.
How did you come to research stuckness in the first place?
Well, most researchers know that the thing you end up researching is the thing that is bothering you most in your life, ironically. And so I was looking at my life and thinking, sure, I'm very stuck here. But then I started looking around and I saw a lot of stuck relationships in people. I saw stuck politics. I saw stuck groups in my work. I saw leaders who were stuck in their leadership style and hadn't been able to adapt. And so I started getting more deeply into understanding what stuckness was and how to become more fluid in life. It was really my own personal experience of stuckness that got me going on the subject. And that's why I say I'm a personal as well as a professional expert on stuckness, because I've enjoyed plenty of opportunities for stuckness in my life.
So why did you complete a doctorate in leadership stuckness?
So I really like existential ideas and psychotherapy. So I was completing that doctorate, and it was done at Middlesex in the UK. So, you know, pre-COVID, I'd go across four lectures. But I also did my internship at a home for people who were sort of permanently hospitalized for certain kinds of mental illnesses. And I noticed in this hospital that a lot of the behaviors exhibited by the people were like stuck in a different time or working in a different context. And that really interested me, that people could live in one context, you know, live in reality in one context and psychically be in a completely different context. And, you know, somehow these two worlds would exist side by side, obviously not very effectively. And then, funnily enough, I started to see this in my leadership development work. Same thing. Leaders in a world stuck in a different time, and their context calling for a different kind of behavior. But the leader was not able to see this and interpret it. And they were getting incredibly frustrated because the dance that they had been doing for so many years had worked. But now all of a sudden, it wasn't working anymore. So that's why I, it was a doctorate. So I did sort of internship and a lot of different modules. It took 5 years. And so by the time I got to the research project, I had a pretty good idea that stuckness was my area of interest. Shall I tell you a little bit about existential psychotherapy? Maybe that's useful as well.
I would be grateful if you would, because I'm not sure I'm very clear on that.
Well, there's not a lot of existential psychotherapists in South Africa. So existential philosophy and psychotherapy focuses on what it means to be human. And when we are human, we have these existential givens. We're thrown into the world and we have to decide what we're going to do with our freedom. How are we going to cope with our death? What are we going to do with our isolation? And how are we going to survive moments of meaninglessness in our lives? And I became very interested in this idea of freedom, which was in a lot of the existential philosophy, people like Heidegger, Sartre, de Beauvoir. And then I noticed very interestingly that some of Sartre's ideas had come to South Africa in the 70s. And one of the people that had been influenced by that work was our very own Steve Biko, who took the ideas and of in particular Sartre and de Beauvoir and started exploring this idea of inner freedom. You can be in chains, but if you can have a sense of inner freedom, that is a completely different thing altogether. So Biko used this in the context of South Africa. And I don't know if we all remember the Bob Marley song, emancipate yourself from mental slavery, none but ourselves can free our mind. And so when I started to look at that work, I became able to separate inner and outer freedom. So my research into stuckness is actually research into inner freedom. How can we be more free inside? How can we work through our socialization, our prejudice, our ideas about the world, our demographics, et cetera, so that we can jump into the world more fully and grasp it with both hands, which is what living existentially is all about.
Thank you for that explanation. If someone wants on a basic level to know what stuckness is, how do you view stuckness?
Yeah, I prefer not to use a theoretical explanation because, when you say stuck or stuckness to people, they get it immediately. They get it. So you can look at it in many ways, but the simplest way is people get stuck when their inner world doesn't relate to their outer world. So, for example, you can get stuck in grieving where your inner world is only concerned with grieving. And so you're walking around the world and you're not seeing opportunities. You're only seeing grief. So when our inner world doesn't connect with our outer world, it's like a plug and a socket. The electricity can't flow, and so we get stuck. Our actions have no tractions, and we start getting frustrated and angry. So, most people identify stuckness as an undesirable state where it's unpleasant, we're frustrated, we feel lost, and, we feel like idiots. We don't know who we are. So that would be a way to describe stuckness that isn't so theoretical.
Yeah, my next question was going to be, how does one identify stuckness? But I'm wondering if I actually want to ask, how does one become aware that one is stuck? Because I don't think what we always realize.
We don't. And what was fascinating about the research was that there's, and I'll go into it later, there's a couple of phases. And we don't actually notice anything different in the first stage. We're like boiling frogs. We don't notice what is happening. We don't notice. So later I'll show you how the first stage is losing ourselves and the next stage is losing others. Generally, people only feel pain when they lose others. Bizarrely and ironically enough, people are happy to lose parts of themselves. That doesn't seem to worry them that much. It doesn't seem to give them that much pain. But it's when they become isolated that it becomes, much more apparent to people. That's how they identify their stuckness. Or if they're a bit more sort of aware, they can notice that their life is getting a bit lackluster. They're getting a bit bored. They're getting a bit argumentative with other people, but they don't know why. Or they keep having dreams of a future, but never able to take any steps. Procrastination. So how you notice it is a change in your inner world. Am I feeling stuck? Am I feeling annoyed with the world? Do I feel lost? Am I frustrated with not getting what I want? Those are the kinds of feelings that point to stuckness.
In your book, Julia, you write that stuckness can occur individually, in pairs, in small groups, and in bigger groups. Could you offer some examples from our personal and work lives? Because as you said, you're both a personal and professional expert on stuckness.
Yeah. Sure. I was quite amazed at how this process, this model applied right across the board. So, you know, I'm going to talk a lot about individual stuckness, but couples get stuck in dances too. You know, they keep doing the same dance for years and years and years, ignoring the same data for years and years and years, and they get stuck in an old dance that becomes less and less kind of happy. In the book, I've got a case study of Avril and Arthur of the small world. And I love this case study because what happens is Avril and Arthur get older, their kids leave the country, and they're still staying in the big house in the suburbs. But as they get older, they become more frail and they start worrying more and more about security, about whether they'll get the medicines they need, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens to this fear is that it starts to make their life smaller and smaller. So they used to zip around all the time visiting people, but now they only drive in daylight and sort of within a 10-kilometer radius. And their world gets smaller and smaller, and they're still in that house together, but there's very little influence coming from outside the world. So for the first time in their marriage, they start to bicker. So, you know, the story explores why are they bickering? Are they bickering because they find each other incredibly irritating? Or are they bickering because they've got stuck and they've created this really small world in order to cope with their feelings of lack of safety and insecurity? So, you know, when couples have been together a long time, you know, you can always say it was because the children have gone and they're bickering now, but very often it's to do with the world they're creating where they can actually explore their love and life. So that's a way couples get stuck. Groups in organizations get stuck all the time, all the time. And, you know, it's once again that thing of one kind of behavior in a group or in a whole organization being learned. And then the context changes and they can't adapt. So they keep doing the older behavior and they have no impact. Their actions have no tractions. Organizations get stuck very often because they don't adapt their mission and vision. So that, you know, organizations start around a particular product or mission and vision, and they learn how to produce it and distribute it really well. And then the context changes, and they're still trying to push the old product, but the world no longer wants it. And so there's a stuckness there. Countries too get stuck. And I think on a sort of a gut level, everyone can kind of look at the world at the moment and say, uh-oh, that country is stuck in a very old behavior. That country is stuck in a very old behavior. It's no surprise there's a lot of war going on. Because that's what happens when two stuck systems collide. They just get more rigid until they implode. So I think, you know, I just love that as an explanation for our very chaotic geopolitical situation at the moment. So, you know, you can get stuck in many, many different ways.
Yeah, I must admit that especially the couple study you shared, I found that very, very interesting because I'm in my 60s now and I talk a lot to people of this age group, and I think that really is a trap one can fall into.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's all about how you read your environment. And when you're older, you are more frail in so many ways. So safety is a big issue. And in South Africa, there's so many signals that you could be in danger, that you could really, really like foreclose on life, you know, instead of figuring a way to live within the context as it is, instead of longing for a context that used to be for certain people.
Julia, your book is called The Art and Joy of Stuckness for Coaches and Their Clients. And I was wondering about the word joy.
Yeah. Oh, stuckness is very joyful, but we tend to forget that. So let me tell you how I got to this. I interviewed a whole lot of South African executives about their experience of getting stuck. I had no shortage of people willing to talk about their stuckness because everyone gets stuck. So, you know, when you're doing a doctorate, you transcribe the interviews and then you code the themes in the interviews. So I coded everything and started building up a narrative, a story of what was going on for the people. I took this to my supervisor, and he said to me, "Julia, why are you so mean to your interviewees?" So I looked at the data, and I realized that I judged them. I judged them as being lazy, as being stupid, entitled, all these sorts of ideas. I judged them. And I was like, wow, how did this happen? This is very curious. And then with a bit of psychotherapy myself, I realized that I was using the same lens for my interviewees as I used for myself. So I'd had so much judgment in my life around my own stuckness. Why couldn't I make this happen? Why couldn't I get this to happen for me? You know, I always thought of myself as having a lot of agency in life and a lot of like energy to make stuff happen. So like, how was it that I kept getting stuck? So I had to change my attitude to my own stuckness in order to change my attitude to my interviewees. This was not an easy job. So I had to think through how I thought about my own stuckness. And a particular aspect of it was my own shame. You know, my shame at not being good enough, getting stuck, being bad, not sorting things out regardless of like the great opportunities I'd had in life. And that was where I started to really learn about the role of shame in getting stuck and how it's not such a terribly useful emotion, because shame can pull you back into the past. And as it does that, it gets you stuck again. Anyway, the story goes that I did a bit of work on myself. Yes, I still have to do more. And I recoded all the data. And I looked at it from a different perspective. A perspective that assumed everyone was deeply competent and well-meaning. And then I realized actually what's going on here is a kind of a rebirth for people. You know, stuckness was a way to gestate the stuff in the past and incubate kind of a new future. And as I changed my attitude towards myself and became more positive and less self-critical, the same thing happened to my data. And eventually it landed up being a joyful moment where I was going, hey, this one got stuck. Fantastic. What are they learning? Brilliant. You know, stuckness is excellent and critical. Everyone does it. You must do it. The problem only comes when it lasts too long. So that's how I found the joy. But it took quite a lot of psychotherapy for me to get there.
I think that's a beautiful story. You referred to incubating the future, and I just want to ask you a question before we go back to the whole idea and model of stuckness about incubating the future. You teach people how to move from stuckness to fluidity. How would you define fluidity?
Yeah, so kind of a way of thinking as you get stuck, then you have this incubation patch. And during that incubation patch, you kind of churn through your history. You see what parts of you you've left behind. You start reframing things, just as I started reframing my relationship to myself. And then you start to sort of venture and do experiments in the world where you become more fluid. A definition of fluidity is when you are fully in touch with yourself, connected to others, have a meaningful existence, and connected to your context so that when you act, it has traction in the world. That's a fluid existence. So you kind of, you have direction, you take advantage of opportunities, you see synchronicities, and things just seem to work.
Thank you. Now getting back to stuckness, what causes stuckness?
Yeah, so, you know, there's many ways to look at this. And as you'll see when I talk about the model is basically humans are not very good at learning. We don't like change neurologically, psychically, in any way. And why we do this is the subject of another conversation, but we don't like change. So, you know, we learn a dance. We hope that dance will still be relevant for a while and we just keep doing it. And we'll keep doing it until the context smacks us on the back of our heads and says, it's time to adapt. So that's one version of how people get stuck. I'm going to go into the mechanics of getting stuck a little bit later. But that's one version, like humans don't like to change. So instead of changing, we'll just pretend the world is the same. Until the world, you know, slaps us and says, hey, we've changed. If you want to talk to us, you'd better do some inner work.
Yeah, just so. You've developed a model of how to use stuckness as a growth point rather than a dead end. And your model has been built in three layers. What are these?
Okay, so when you look at the like full model, it's quite complicated. So it's much easier to break it into three layers. So the first most simple layer is that it's just a normal cycle of learning and growth. We kind of learn a dance, we do a dance, and we just keep doing that dance. And we're unable to emerge. The context changes. And so we are forced to learn a new dance. That's basically how it is, that we learn the new dance, we do the dance, but we do the dance too long, and then the context says, wake up and change. So this is like a normal healing and growth cycle. And, you know, you can look at the work of Freud, Jung, Heidegger, Winnicott, Kolb, and other people, and see that this kind of, this basic learning model is the core of all of their models. The second way to see stuckness is as a process of losing three things and gaining three things. So we lose ourselves, we lose others, and we lose meaning. And those three losses result in us getting stuck. And then in order to become more fluid, we gain self, gain others, and gain meaning. We're going to go through this in more detail later, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
I'll just leave it there then, because it's three losses and three gains. And that's what basically, you know, we lose connection with ourselves, with others, and meaning. We get lost, we get stuck, we get frustrated, and then we're forced to go inwards and renew ourselves. And in order to do that, we have to regain our full self, reconnect to others, and find an appropriate meaning for our life at this point. So the third layer of the cycle. So we've got the in the middle, we've got the just the normal cycle of healing and growth. Then we've got the three losses and the three gains. And the third layer has got five kind of stages. And I'm going to just mention them super briefly because we're going to look at them more deeply. And one of these processes is a bit tricky. So I don't want to frustrate your listeners now and give them a half story or interrupt the broader narrative of today. But basically, we have an incomplete wounding, looking for healing. The wound is woken up by the environment. We get into the wound. We lose ourselves, others, and meaning, and we get stuck. Then we have to go inside, process pain, anger, shame, and most importantly, grief, and then start rebuilding ourselves. Once we rebuild ourselves, we become more fluid, and we enter the last stage, which is peaking and plateauing. You know, that's when we learn the new dance really well, which we're now going to carry on doing until the context wakes us up again. So that's the third layer. First layer is healing cycle. The second layer is the three losses. The third layer introduces the idea that there's some sort of historical wound that's coming up for engagement and healing.
You've now mentioned the five stages, and perhaps you can go into more detail the five stages of the stuckness cycle.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. So let's have a think. What happens is we kind of doing a dance, okay? We've done that dance for a while, and we go into a new context. Say we get a new job, and we get into this new context, and this new context kind of wakes up some old wounding from our childhood or from a previous context or something, some sort of unfinished business. So for example, you know, maybe if you grew up in a family that valued compliance over expression, you might go, wow, okay, I'm good at compliance and perfectionism. Then you enter like a banking environment. Say you enter a banking environment that is incredibly hierarchical, you know, in some ways that is a bit reminiscent of your family. Be compliant, stay in the hierarchy, don't be too weird, you know, all of those kinds of rules apply. So now you enter an environment that speaks to this incompletion in your childhood. Maybe you wanted to be a bit more expressive. Maybe you didn't want to be beholden to someone else's rules. But now you're back in that kind of culture of your family of origin. So you have this opportunity to finish off or kind of fix some of that wounding. Or maybe on its most simple level, you have an opportunity to respond differently this time. For those of you that know the Kaufman triangle, which is, you know, victim, rescuer, perpetrator. So if in the last context you might have been a victim, maybe you get into a new context that is reminiscent of the previous context, and this time you might play the rescuer role or the perpetrator role. So it's very much in the sort of feel of Freudian repetition compulsion, even though Freud's not always included as an existential source. But this idea that these incompletions come up to be fixed. I mean, that's the very ambitious nature of our inner worlds. So we go into a context, something comes up for healing, and the next thing that happens is we start living more fully. Okay, sorry. Let me just go back. So we enter a context and we learn how to behave in that context. I know I'm overusing the dance metaphor, but sorry about that. I'm going to just keep going. So we learn a dance. So for example, this person enters the banking environment. They learn the dance. This is a dance they know from before in their family. It's all fantastic. But at the same time, their incomplete issue is looking to complete. And so what happens to this person is that they've got a dance that they can do, but they want to maybe do something different this time. When they're stuck in the dance, what happens is they disconnect from their full self. So their full self, for example, of this person, would include the joker, the dirty one, the one that comes late, all the bad stuff that was trained out of this person in their early childhood. So what's happened is they've actually amputated parts of themselves in the new context so that they can keep doing that dance. So we lose ourselves by amputating parts of ourselves. We also lose ourselves by becoming bewitched. When I talk about bewitchment, it's when something like an idea or even a person outside you takes control of your life. A lot of people get bewitched by success. You know, people looking for a career might come in and, you know, say, what do you want to do? And they say, I want to be successful. So, I mean, it's like a very odd thing, but it's there. And so they only build their psyche and the inner world around what success looks like. And all the bits that are not useful in that vision are amputated. So they are no longer in control of their life. They are bewitched by something. The last way we can lose ourselves is by dying to ourselves. Now, often this happens through trauma, but it can also happen, you know, when people are objectified from very young and they never learn to grow their inner worlds. An example that I use in the book is Angelique, the 90-year-old coquette. So the story of Angelique is that she became like a child model, an actress. And her mother thought this was the way to go, and she didn't go to school. So she didn't build herself out during those earlier years. And then she went on, to cut a long story short, she went on to be a trophy wife. And the bit of the story I love the most about her, because it's so different to me, is, you know, she had four children and she was back to a flat stomach within a week.
Mm.
But, and then life went on. She was rich. She was the belle of the ball, but she was very much objectified by her husband and her environment. She got a bit depressed in her 70s, and the therapist said, oh, well, I think you are suffering from a bit of death anxiety. And he suggested that Angelique spend more time with her grandchildren. And she didn't really want to do that because seeing her grandchildren reminded her of how old she was. All this time, she'd been nipping and tucking because she was focused on the exterior. Anyway, Angelique went off to the old age home, and there she was in a wheelchair with her toenails done, her latest facial, and flirting inappropriately with guests and members of staff. And that's why I was called in, because she was saying quite rude stuff to people. She was still a coquette. Her children had not visited her for a while because she hadn't really connected with them. And so in her later life, she was still trying to live out her life as a 20-year-old. She hadn't built her inner world fully enough, and her inner world hadn't adapted to her life stage. So she'd become a problem for the old age home. So I was brought in. And the thing there is that, you know, to help her at 90 build out her inner world so much that she can start having more engaged relationships with her grandchildren and children, and better relationships with other people. Because her story really was, she spent so much of her life looking after her outside, you know, how she looked. And now she was like 90 and there was no one to validate her because she was looking 90. Well, maybe 65. She'd had quite a bit of work. But, you know, there was no one to validate her work and there was no inner world available for her to connect with her peers. Anyway, she did do it. She started finding ways of creating meaning and building up her inner world. But just cutting back to the story I was on, you know, she had died to herself quite early on in life. And so to rebuild herself was quite a lot of work. So you lose yourself by becoming bewitched, amputated, or dead. And when you have a narrow self, your ability to adapt and transform diminishes. So the more kind of identities we have inside, the fuller our self is, the easier it is for us to adapt. You know, if I only have one title, which is mom, when I have non-mom situations, I might not know how to react. But if I have mom, racing car driver, international gun smuggler, and poet, you know, in my identity kind of sack, then I have a lot of flexibility in how I respond to the world. So, you know, we lose our capacity for adapting when we have a narrow self. So that's the first loss of self. The second loss is the loss of engaged relationships with others.
Regarding Dr. Julia Cookard's book, The Art and Joy of Stuckness for Coaches and Their Clients. You know, you don't need academic terminology to know what being stuck looks and feels like. You've been there. I've been there. It's an intrinsic part of being human and an entry-level requirement for being a coach. The existential function of stuckness is to digest our pasts and incubate our new future. We cannot and should not avoid it. Instead of being hobbled by the pain of stuckness, we can learn to love its tacky mud, milk it for its rejuvenation gifts, and enjoy living with a raised middle finger it points at our lives. This book will tell you how. Based on a doctoral thesis, this book takes us through the cycle of stuckness. We learn how to work with incomplete wounds and the loss of ourself, others, and meaning. When we do this well, we become fluid, fully in ourselves, connected to others, and emboldened by a life of meaning. We can live in the world as it is, not as we are in it. This book provides practical ways to work with stuckness for coaches and their clients. Relatable case studies from around the world have been included. The tone is conversational and riddled with existential humor in line with the nature of stuckness itself.
The second loss is the loss of engaged relationships with others. Now, we have to have those because they teach us how to be human and we grow and learn in relationship. We can do a little bit on the side on our own, but most of our learning comes through others because when we look at others, we get an insight into how we are or how others experience us. So when we don't have connected relationships, we're not getting feedback, it's very hard for us to adapt. And it's quite a tricky thing, you know, with the leaders that I spoke to. So they'd lost themselves. They were doing a very old dance and they were not successful in the corporate world. No one wanted to work with them. And eventually they became more and more isolated. So they didn't have engaged relationships to support them and to help them grow. And so if you don't have that, you know, you're going to just keep spinning forward into stuckness. The third loss is meaning. So meaning is a funny thing. It's so important for humans. Meaning allows us to kind of have the courage to get over the daily grind. And the daily grind can make us homicidal or suicidal. We need meaning, something beyond ourselves to kind of put effort into big projects or get through life in general. And what happens is that we can easily lose meaning, or meaning that's meaningful. We can lose meaning by focusing on the wrong sources of meaning. We can lose meaning by not having meaning distributed across our lives. One of the case studies I looked at in the book is Jane, the justice fighter. She is an owner of a donut world. So she had a very meaningful job, but when she got home, there was nothing there. The meaning was not distributed across her life. So we need to think about where meaning is in our life. Is it okay to just have a meaningful work and nothing at home? Or is it okay to just have meaning at home and not at work? So people often think that meaning gets kind of given to you automatically. And in the existential way of thinking, this is not true. We have to make meaning. And sometimes it's quite hard to do this, but we have to make it. So like sometimes it's easy to make meaning if we have kids and other stuff, kids and gardens and things that grow. We can get meaning that way. But it becomes much more stark when we're getting old, we have no kids, and we're not going to have a job. Then like, what is the meaning of our life going to be? Because we need meaning to keep surviving, and humans are meaning-making organisms. Without meaning, you know, life, it's very hard to continue living. So in that, I look a lot at the work of Viktor Frankl, who says that if our life is not actually meaningful because it's cruel or for other reasons, you know, he was speaking about concentration camps. But if our life is not meaningful, then we can create meaning by how we approach our life, which is such a fascinating thing, you know, when we look at the hardship people go through, and the meaning can be just in the attitude they bring to the situation. So now we've lost self, we've lost others, and we've lost meaning. And when all three come together, we get stuck. This is the time we get angry, we get annoyed, and we get resentful. For the leaders I spoke to, this is also a time when they started to do bad things to corporates. So when we get stuck, we get very angry, and we're not sure where to kind of express that. But if we get stuck at work, then we're going to use work as a target. And if we can't be openly aggressive, we might be covertly aggressive. And this is when, you know, people commit acts of fraud or steal time or steal stationery, or in the one organization I worked with, steal hose pipes. So that's what happens at that point. We're now stuck, we're frustrated. We've been trying to act into the world, and it's had no traction. We don't know, we lost. So now we're in like a developmental impasse where we have to go inwards. And the job here is to go inwards and figure out what's going on. Noticing that if we keep trying to be the person we were, things are not going to work out. And so we'd better start working on the person who's going to emerge, and start cleaning up some of the things from the past. So when we're in this state, we experience pain. Now, our society, our world, doesn't love pain. In fact, there's kind of a covert message that if you have pain, you must get rid of it. You don't have to have pain. But in the case of stuckness, pain is very useful because it moves you into action. In the instances where people took antidepressants or meditated their pain away, often they didn't have the energy to start going again. So, I mean, one of the things around stuckness to do is to build your capacity for pain. Don't narcotize it away. Get strong. you know, because pain is very, very useful. The second thing that happens is shame. So shame, like everyone has seen me get stuck. I've seen myself. Clearly, I'm not good enough. And I've spoken a little bit about this earlier, how important it is to work through shame. And there are particular ways that you can do it. One of the ways I use is to say, well, that shame may or may not have been perfectly appropriate for an earlier context, but it is certainly not appropriate now. That belongs in the past. And it doesn't even belong to me. It belongs to my parents, if they're the ones that gave it, or whatever. There's certain ways of working through shame. But if you have a lot of shame, it's going to keep pulling you back into the past. The last thing that happens during this stage of stuckness is grief. Now, grief is brilliant. So if you felt stuck and now you find yourself grieving, you must start shouting hallelujah. Because grief is the sort of clarion call to fluidity. Some of the things that people have to grieve might be related to their early lives. But a big one is grieving unlived lives. You know, if I hadn't got stuck, I might have been CEO. I might have got that boy. I might have, you know, all these unlived lives. So we have to grieve them. We have to let go of them. And it's really important to grieve properly. Because if you don't grieve properly, that grief's going to come back and it wants more attention. Even if you grieve properly, that grief might come back. So this is an important stage, and it's really quite a lovely, lovely stage. So now we've grieved, we've let go of something, we've kind of pulled ourselves out of the past, which we were held in through grief and shame. And now we can start going back in our life and saying, oh, what part of myself have I amputated that might be useful now? Oh, my creativity. Lovely. I wonder how I can use this. How can I build this art? And so we start exploring ourselves. And then we're broadening ourselves. And then the next stage is to build engaged relationships with others. I used to believe that you kind of have to grow yourself fully and then you kind of get out there, especially when it comes to dating, you know. Fix your inner world and then you can take it out there and hope you find someone to meet it. But I've been looking at the work of Esther Perel, and she says, you're never going to be fully formed for starters. But secondly, you grow in relationship to each other. So, you know, work on yourself, but also get out there at the same time because you'll grow in that relationship. And the last stage of kind of coming out of stuckness is finding meaning that's appropriate. So meaning, using it to direct your life. How am I going to grow? You know, what's on my bucket list? What do I want them to say at my funeral? What is meaningful to me? And it's important to build meaning that is appropriate to your life stage. What I always find very funny, I saw someone at a party saying, oh, I've got the same value system I had when I was 20. And I thought, goodness, I wouldn't say that. That's a sort of, you know, an admission of being stuck. Mm. Because meaning and values need to change in relation to your life. So, you know, that's back to the meaning thing. Build meaning that is distributed across your life, that is meaningful. You know, stop wedging meaning into a designer handbag. And put it somewhere where it's transpersonal, because transpersonal value, transpersonal meaning is actually what makes humans tick. So you can have meaning and growth and learning and those sorts of things, personal development, but it's ultimately the transpersonal value of helping others, being together in some way that can enliven a life. So now we've found our full self, we've found engaged relationships, we've found meaning. And yay, we can connect to the context and we are fluid. We are moving around fluidly. We can see opportunities and we feel great. This is a time of feeling brilliant. There is a possible problem here, and that is that because we're feeling so great. You know, we become puffed up with how brilliant we are. Yay, we got through stuckness. We must be brilliant. So we can build a level of hubris, arrogance about who we are, because we might not imagine getting stuck again. So we must always remember that. And the second thing is, when we are fluid, we might get stuck holding on to our fluidity. Okay, that sounds mad. Let me explain. So we might love being fluid so much that when we start seeing the signals around stuckness, we keep innovating and changing too fast. And there's a stuckness in this because we never take the learning and concretize it. We're just rolling round and round and round and round in an unsatisfying way. We get kind of addicted to being fluid, and that itself is a form of stuckness. So, yeah, we are now fluid and we're doing the stuff and we're plateauing and we're having a brilliant life. And then, hey, it all starts all over again. And so, you know, I always say to people that the thing here is to want to get stuck often and easily. You know, try for once a month. Mm. Or just that's how you're going to keep more fluid than more stuck. Don't hold on to your fluidity. Don't hold on to your stuckness. Just keep flowing and adapting and learning and growing, connecting to yourself, connecting to others, looking at the world, and making sure your meaning is relevant to where you are. So that's a very long story there. I'm sorry about that length. I hope people could visualize this kind of cycle and that I didn't, you know, flood them with words and confuse them.
No, I think you did it in a very logical way. What I was wondering, I know that your book and also your work is very much focused on the context of coaching, but I was wondering if someone reads this book, could they work with this on their own?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the book is written for coaches and clients. And there's bits and bobs that might be a bit sort of dense, you know, with existential stuff, but it's written to be read by, yeah, somebody, by the general public as well. And I think what makes it accessible is these case studies. So if you get stuck on the theory, then you just pop into the case study and you can pop back if you want to, you know, see how you go. It's absolutely written for the man, the educated man on the street.
Yes, I love your case studies. Couldn't you regale us with one of them, please?
I love Paula and the Sexy Panty.
Yes.
And I love Paula because I'm in that middle-aged section of my life. So the backstory is that Paula had birthed, weaned, and almost completed the schooling of three children. She'd done this with George, who'd been helpful most of the time. They'd worked like a Trojan couple on those children, on the house, on George and his job. Money had just flowed into the house and the children, and they tightened up on their own personal luxuries. In fact, they very rarely spent anything on themselves at all. At the time I met her, Paula was in a premenopausal patch of getting fat, having heavy, painful periods, sprouting hairs, and clouded by bad moods. She felt like a tired workhorse, disinterested in herself, in George, in sex, and even the children. She described her body as something extra and heavy to carry about. It was undisciplined, slinking over to the fridge, lurching off to chairs, slumping at tables, and waiting for when it could slip into bed with Netflix and a gin. Netflix and gin were, to all intents and purposes, her primary loves at this stage in her life. Over the years, Paula's underwear had moved from girlish panties to feeding bras to supermarket panties to corrective and restraining shapewear, to period panties, and then to shapeless granny bloomers whose bottoms bunched up under her jeans like a nappy. Her undergarments never veered into the realm of the sexy panty, and the string was never welcomed into her grey drawer holding her smalls, which in fact were rather large. Furthermore, these grey, misshapen things were not replaced regularly enough because they did not show to the outer world, or so Paula thought. In Paula's mind, bush coverage was a practical affair aimed at keeping clothes fresh and gussets unsullied. So at the ripe age of 46, Paula mistakenly ordered a pair of sexy panties online. She was multitasking at the time. She clicked and bought the wrong pair. And then it was too late. The universe had intervened and her life would be changed forever. She was alone when they arrived and still not dressed because she spent the morning cleaning the fridge and the kitchen floor. After a shower and brief look in her drawer of smalls that actually were large, she realized she was fresh out of undergarments, and in a desperate attempt to make the lift club, she slipped the mistaken order on. They went on, all satiny and smooth, gliding over her body like it was 18, and finally falling into place as if they had been made for her. It was quite surprising how she felt in them, and so she walked over to the mirror to see what had happened to her bottom half. There before her was a sexy woman. The panties revealed the good bits and hid the parts she felt less attracted to. Oh my word, she was a goddess after all. For the rest of the day, Paula slithered about in her sexy panties. They did not stick to her jeans, push her belly up into a muffin, or waterfall into the ravine of her butt. She felt sexy and sassy, and it reminded her of a previous life when this feeling had been more regular. The same sensation led her to activities of a nocturnal nature, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and then on to a shopping trip for more panty products. You see, the sexy panty had woken up a part of Paula that was asleep, but once woken and acted upon, was intrinsically rewarding and built up a momentum of its own that moved beyond the bedroom and into her life. So not all panties are created equal, and not everyone's life force is so ready to burst into flame. But in this case, the panty was truly gorgeous and sexy and reminded Paula of a previous way of being. This sexy panty had in some mysterious way added just enough excitement and life force to get the balls rolling towards a more fluid and enjoyable life. The powerful panty was the catalyst for change. So this is not a treatment I would prescribe for everyone, especially those of us who have shopping or sexwear addictions. But I'm sure you get the idea of how an object can remind us of parts of ourselves that we thought we had lost. And through this remembering, we can invite these discarded parts back. It is also a story of how so-called mistakes are often the openings for change, and that Freudian slips are often the best way to crack open the door into a new life. This is a kind of a non-coach, non-psychological story where an object does the work. And I love that because of that.
Yeah. And what a great example of your captivating writing style, Julia.
Thank you very much for that, Mariette. I really do enjoy these little case studies. And, you know, I've been sort of coaching for like 25, 30 years. So I wish I could do more of them. I've been so lucky to share people's inner worlds. I can't wait to write more of those.
And taking a closer look at your book, you write that coaches and therapists can also get stuck. Are you going to tell us how this can happen?
Yeah, this happens in many ways. So firstly, coaches and psychotherapists are actually humans, and so they get stuck in the same ways that humans do. But there's quite a few other ways, and I cover it quite extensively in the book. So I'm just going to maybe talk about two ways now. And the one way is if we project our life into the client, or maybe our wounds into the client. So I remember when I was a learner coach, and I was like a short, squat thing that didn't have a lot of money, and I was struggling, had bad self-image. And this gorgeous woman came in for coaching. She was beautiful. She was clever. She was rich. And, you know, it took me a while to kind of like so why are you here? Why do you need coaching? You've got everything I want. So, you know, that's projecting into the client. We can also project ourselves into their stories. We can also turn ourselves into the superheroes of their stories, the rescuers, when actually what we want is for them to become their own heroes. One of the case studies I look at relates to a coach, and this coach we call Hatchet Harriet. So Hatchet Harriet had been in corporates, and she'd been like specializing in retrenchments, hence the name. People kind of were scared of her. Then she got divorced, and she'd been the major wage earner. And so her husband took 50%, and then she decided she had to leave corporate, but she didn't actually have enough money because of the divorce. She might have had enough money, but her experience was that she needed more. So she trained as a coach, did all the like right stuff. And then because she was so good at hatcheting, all sorts of people gave her work. And so she was chock-a-block. And she was treating clients as objects of revenue instead of engaging with them. So the clients tended to be sent to her for kind of remedial coaching. And she had a process that she could take people and turn them into kind of corporate beasts that could be successful in very competitive corporate environments. So she was coaching for the revenue. She was creating a sausage machine instead of helping people find their individuality. She was training them into being corporate objects. So in the kind of existential frame, she was objectifying them. And she was also becoming cynical. She was very tired. She was very lonely. I know how it can be when you're working so hard with your clients, you're like seeing far too many a day. And by the time you get home to your family, you've got nothing left to give anyone, nothing to give your friends. You've given it all to the client, so you become cynical and burned out. And she was, you know, treating herself like a coaching machine that didn't have feelings, that just kind of needed to focus on the job and, you know, get through the next client and get paid and get their boss to agree that this person now has changed. Tick. So she was objectifying clients, and that's a stuck coach. Stuck coaches objectify clients and turn them into objects of revenue. We need revenue, and we also need to support clients' individuality and their expression into the world. So with Hatchet Harriet, the work was really about building out her individuality. And when you coach, language is so important because words define worlds. And so one of the things we did with Harriet was expand her vocabulary. So try to move her away from like coachisms, you know, encourage her to swear here and there, just so that we get out of the do-gooder mold. And as her internal world expanded, her vocabulary expanded, she became more authentic. She brought more of herself to the coaching sessions, and her clients were happier. So she had to work through objectifying herself and objectifying her clients. And so just a story there about how coaches can get stuck.
Yeah, it seems to me your book will definitely work with a coach with coaches themselves on a personal as well as a work level.
Yeah, I hope so.
Julia, I wanted to point out that each chapter ends with a set of questions. And why is this?
Well, I'm hoping to get people to think. You know, one of the questions for coaches or psychotherapists is, can you parallel process? Can you be with your client and yourself at the same time? So that's sort of a challenging thing to think about in your session. So it's really hoping to ground the learning and help people think through things. Yeah.
Where can listeners find the art and joy of stuckness for coaches and their clients?
Yeah, thank you. So at the moment, Loot and Amazon are selling the book. And it should be in exclusive books. I can't guarantee when, but the launch of the book is at exclusives on the 20th of March. So I know people have been buying it with great ease off Loot and Amazon, and it should be up on exclusives available as well.
And where can listeners learn more about your work?
Well, a lot of my work is completed through Euphoria, which is the company I started with Simon Kettleborough and Lucille Hrief. And you spell it A-E-P-H-O-R-I-A. And if you go onto YouTube and search Euphoria, you will find hundreds of videos and podcasts, one of which is on stuckness, which shows you kind of how to use the model. But there's a lot of information that can be found there. You can also look at my website, jcookard.com, and also at Euphoria's website, A-E-P-H-O-R-I-A, euphoriagroup.com. Have a look. There's a lot out there, and I find it fascinating. I hope you do too.
Thank you, Julia. I will attach those links to the podcast.
Great, thank you.
Now it's time for your three tips on stuckness and fluidity.
Yeah. Oh, I've got a brain that thinks in bullet points rather than paragraphs, bizarrely enough. And so I love things like three tips. So I think the thing is, in life, some of us think, you know, when I get this, I'm going to be happy. When I get that, I'm going to be happy. When I stop being stuck, I'm going to be happy. My top tips are to really enjoy being stuck. You know, it can entitle you to being badly behaved. I can be grumpy because I'm stuck. You know, I think you've got to enjoy your stuckness. Enjoy it because that's what it's there for you, incubating. You know, you walk around like a grumpy pregnant woman. Be rude to people. Eat more than usual. Behave badly. Enjoy being stuck. And then enjoy your fluidity, but not too much. You know, enjoy being fluid and love life when things just work and synchronicities pop into your lap. And then the one thing that is so hard for humans to do, and that is don't lose access to all of yourself. Don't amputate. Don't kill yourself. And watch out for becoming bewitched. If we allow other things to colonize our inner world, we're not going to be able to produce a life that's satisfying to ourselves. And we're not going to be able to produce a life that utilizes our uniqueness to provide something of value to the world. Don't lose connection to yourself.
Thank you, Julia. Will you now allow me to ask you a fun question?
Absolutely. Okay. What is it?
If you were a very busy honeybee, where would you like to get stuck?
You know, the sort of greedy girl in me wants to be in the honey.
Ah, shortcut.
But honey can be sticky, hey? And with those little bee feet, you might be trapped for good. I think in the air, where I still have a a view of what's going on in the world, and I can still move, even if I'm a little bit hungry. That's where I want to be stuck.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you, Julia. And thank you. I must say that since I started reading your book, I've got this idea of looking for stuckness everywhere. And I have found it in more places than I like.
Yes, it's amazing. Hey?
But sometimes it also explains things.
Yeah. That's why it's so important to have a compassionate approach to one's own stuckness.
Yes, and one's own, and I would say to that of others as well.
Yeah.
So thank you very, very much for these insights and for the book you've written and for the work that you are doing and are still going to do.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you, Mariette.
To our listeners, it was good of you to join us. I'd be honored if you'd subscribe to this podcast series, and if you found this episode meaningful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear, and Helpful, is produced by me with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.